Your Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for the welcome, for the far-reaching introduction, which took me back to the age of 13, more years ago than I care to remember. And thank you to the Institute for Cultural Diplomacy for inviting me here to attend this conference and for the lateral thinking implied in their decision to come to my door, because I'm not actually a diplomat. In fact, sometimes I'm not very diplomatic at all. But then the definition in my country of a diplomat is someone sent to lie abroad for their country. I try never to lie, and I'm extremely critical of my country, both in its current role in relation to conflicts in the world, and indeed its history as an imperial power. I come from an Irish background, and once I came home from school and told my Irish grandfather that the teacher had told us that the British had an empire so vast that upon it the sun never set. And my grandfather answered, "That's because God would never trust the British in the dark." And I never had cause to doubt him, and nothing much has changed in the many decades since that conversation. So I'm not here as a diplomat, neither am I here in any sense as an impartial commentator. I'm partial, I'm a combatant in many of the great international issues that in one way or another you have all been discussing, and it won't take you long to work out what my stance in those combats is. As you can see from my title, they asked me to have a title, and I didn't have one. I thought about just putting a question mark, but thought it would be more explicit this way. For I want to argue that though we are meeting more or less on the anniversary of the disappearance of a very famous, infamous wall, in fact, the walls in the world continue to grow, continue to be built. Some of them are made of concrete, one of which I want to talk about, but some are invisible walls, which are far, far more divisive than any concrete wall could be, and indeed are a barrier to many things, not least a barrier to understanding. It's always been my view that you have to, in life as well as in politics, learn to walk for a mile in the other person's shoes. You have to see the world, be able to see the world, through the side of the telescope that they are looking through. And it seems to me that much of contemporary diplomacy, government policy, and indeed media coverage singularly fails that test. And I hope to develop that argument over the course of the next 25 minutes or so. And then I think there'll be questions. But I'm one of these people who quite likes questions during the speech. So if I say something that seems to, if the chair will permit me, if I say something that seems to prompt an immediate question, please put your hand up. I'll be more than happy to deal with it. So the Berlin Wall disappeared. I have recently come from a place where another concrete wall, as well as an invisible wall, have been recently erected. The concrete wall, of course, is what we call the apartheid wall in the West Bank of Palestine, which I believe is the heart of the matter. It's the heart of the conflict between the East and the West. It's the heart of the conflict between the Muslim world and the non-Muslim world. And it's the flaw at the heart of Western policy in the world. Of course, not all Western countries are equally culpable. My own country is one of the more culpable. Germany, less in recent times. in the mistaken policies being followed in the Middle East. But Palestine is the heart of the matter. And the fact that vast numbers of parliamentarians, legislators, correspondents, and diplomats still have failed to grasp that truth, which I first discovered more than 35 years ago, so at the age of 21, it continues to puzzle me how, when it's so obviously the case that Western policy towards Palestine is so filled with double standards, has contributed so much to injustice, that it is bound to be a kind of core reactor that is burning the feelings of the people in the Muslim world in particular, and that that reactor is a very dangerous piece of inflammable material. And all sorts of horrors have been visited in the world, fueled by this sense that the West has double standards towards the Palestine question and is deeply complicit in one of the greatest injustices of our age. The Palestine people, whom I shall call the Palestinians, though later in my talk I'll have to define that more closely, were dispersed across the world 62 years ago. That's a very long time. It's before the vast majority of people in this room were even born. Their country was wiped off the map. We hear a lot of talk about people threatening to wipe other people's countries off the map, though actually if you translate properly from the original, you find that that's not what was said at all, but leave that aside. The central truth is that only one country in that region has been wiped off the map, and that country is Palestine. Go to your atlas and you will see the Palestinian people were dispersed across the world into exile. Lucky ones in Germany, maybe there are some in the room, there usually are in rooms wherever I go. The unlucky ones, now in their millions, dispersed to rancid refugee camps in the neighboring Arab countries, principally in Lebanon, in Jordan, and in Syria. But you can find Palestinians dispersed in Brazil, in Timbuktu, anywhere you go, because an entire people, virtually, was cast to the four winds, where they have lived for 62 years without statehood, without status, without passports, without an ability to move, without the ability to get visas, and of course in some countries regularly hunted from pillar to post, chased out of one country after another, subject to regular attack, even massacre. It is a very long-running sore. And what makes it harder to bear is that they, who are the victims of a massive act of expropriation, of violence, I would argue of terrorism, are called the victims. That they are the victims, they're called the terrorists. And the people who visited this crime upon them are called the respectable state for whom red carpets must be rolled out, and a state, moreover, that is forever cap in hand and receiving massive subventions running into billions of dollars every year, principally from the United States, but also from others, including Germany. They are the perpetrators of the terror, yet are called the victims, and the Palestinians who are the victims of this terror are called the terrorists. And that adding of insult to injury is one of the main double standards of which I speak. The Palestinian disaster, or Nakba, as it's described in Arabic, more properly translated as catastrophe, continues until this day. Regularly, the Palestinians have been driven from one country to another. In 1967, so 43 years ago, a second wave of mass expulsion of Palestinians took place after the Six-Day War, when the State of Israel conquered the remaining parts of Palestine and took also pieces of land, pieces of territory, including very symbolically and significant parts of other people's countries, some of which they hold until this day. Now, I focus on 1967, though many other such events I could adduce as part of my argument here, because as you are people involved in diplomacy, as either as students or interns or as retired diplomats, in this case, 1967, there's not just a moral case which I can deploy, but a legal one. The occupation of the West Bank of the Jordan, of East Jerusalem, and of the Gaza Strip were absolutely illegal acquisitions. There is no question about that. International law is very clear that you may not occupy someone else's territory by force. You may not alter the demography inside that occupied territory. You cannot change the political system inside that territory. You cannot build illegal settlements in that occupied territory. And ever since 1967, 43 years, on an annual basis, the United Nations Security Council resolutions making the points I have just made are ritually reintroduced and ritually passed, but are completely ignored. Israel, therefore, I can say to you without fear of contradiction, has broken more United Nations Security Council resolutions than all of the countries of the United Nations put together. Yet, is not only never punished for this vast act over 43 years of international lawbreaking, not only never punished, but endlessly rewarded. Rewarded by billions of dollars every year from the United States, by more billions of dollars raised in private philanthropy in the United States, by an endless supply of the most fearsome and up-to-date weaponry, mainly from the United States, and is given most favored nation status with the European Union, so that it can more or less trade as if it were a part of the European Union. They even play in the European football tournaments. They even get to sing in the Eurovision Song Contest, though that might be some kind of punishment. I don't know. It certainly doesn't fit the crime if that's how it's intended. And so you have to ask yourselves, number one, how does it come to pass that the world's biggest lawbreaker, which has broken more UN resolutions than all the countries of the world put together, is not punished but endlessly rewarded? And the second question you have to ask yourself, here I ask you to put on the other fellow's shoes, how do you think that looks from the standpoint of the other person's shoes? How do you think it looks, for example, to the nearly 2 billion Muslims in the world, that Iraq could be sanctioned and broken on the wheel with a child, an Iraqi child, dying every 6 minutes of every day and night before the war, then another 1 million deaths in the war and in the occupation that followed, to punish it for breaking United Nations Security Council resolutions that it turned out she was not even breaking. Yet Israel is not broken on the wheel, not invaded, not occupied, but is forever treated as if it were a respectable member of the international community. How do you think that looks, feels? What do you think that does to the psyche in the Muslim world, whom we're forever lecturing about our love for the rule of law, democracy, liberty, freedom. I could talk all night about those double standards, but time precludes me saying more than this. When you claim that your system is based upon the fundamental need for all states to adhere to the rule of law, when you are arming, financing, and buttressing in every political and diplomatic way an international rogue state, then you are exposed, at the very least, as hypocrites. I give just one more example. I'm the founder of an organization called Viva Palestina. You can check it out on the web, vivapalestina.org. We run convoys to Gaza to break the absolutely illegal, unlawful siege imposed on Gaza, to which I shall come in a minute. Recently, we took the fifth of those convoys into Gaza. The fourth was the so-called Freedom Flotilla, seven ships which sailed out of Turkey, containing humanitarians, human rights workers, bishops, archbishops, former admirals, former ambassadors, former parliamentarians, serving parliamentarians, hundreds of us. In international waters, in an act of piracy, no other word for it, Israeli commandos landed from the air and from the sea on the biggest of the ships, the Mavi Marmara, and in cold blood murdered nine humanitarian aid workers, eight of them Turkish, the ninth a US citizen, leaving a tenth brain dead who will never recover, wounded scores, something like 60, and kidnapped more than 600 people whom they took in handcuffs to a specially built jail in the Negev desert, whereupon they were robbed of all their things, even their underwear. They all left with their suitcases empty. If you don't believe me, check out the court reports from Jerusalem where soldiers were caught selling their computers and their mobile phones in a street market. Can you imagine if Iran had boarded a ship in international waters and attacked and murdered nine people, a ship that was completely unarmed? I know that. I was there. We had inspectors inspecting the cargo and the people. The Turkish government a member of NATO, vouchsafed for the fact that there were no weapons or any kind of contraband on board. Can you imagine if Iran had boarded this ship in international waters and murdered nine people? What do you think the effect in the world would be? We'd probably be at war with Iran now if that crime had been committed by them. But it was not committed by them. It was committed by Israel, and the consequence, despite condemnation from the United Nations panel, which was established by the Security Council to investigate the crime, the consequences have been absolutely zero. No punishment of any kind. And there are many, many other examples I could adduce. The murder of a Palestinian official in Dubai using stolen passports from Britain, Germany, France, Australia, all sorts of countries, mostly countries, by the way, that are forever telling us how friendly they are towards Israel, how much they love Israel. Well, Israel doesn't love them, at least not enough, not to steal their passports to carry out an act of murder in a third country. These double standards, this special license to kill and occupy that has been granted, in effect, by Western countries to Israel, is fueling a rage, a towering rage in the Muslim world, which is dangerous to us. It's not just immoral what we're doing, it's dangerous what we're doing. It's fueling a hatred. It's fueling a swamp, if I can put it that way. It's filling a swamp of hatred and bitterness, out of which many monstrous things are coming. The whole Al-Qaeda phenomenon, this madness of self-incineration, including on a grand scale in New York, in London, in Madrid, and elsewhere. So we need to stop this. Not just because it's immoral, but because it's dangerous and inimical to our own interests. This has begun to be recognized in the United States more than in Europe, believe it or not. General Petraeus, the war hero of the moment, told the Senate Armed Services Committee in Washington just 2 or 3 months ago that the one side, I'm quoting him directly, the one-sided special relationship between the United States and Israel has become a strategic liability to the United States. And none of the senators could demur, for they all know that this has the benefit of being absolutely true. Now, what about the invisible walls? Well, I said I'd come back to Gaza, and here I do. Let me say, just for the avoidance of doubt, although I've said it 10,000 times, let me make it 10,001. I am not, nor have I ever been, a supporter of Hamas. If I had a vote in the Palestinian elections, which I really should after 35 years of working so hard for the cause, it wouldn't be for Hamas. I was with President Arafat from my age of 21, and I was with him in Paris in the hospital when he died. I'm not a supporter of Hamas, but I am a supporter of democracy. And the only people entitled to choose the leadership of the Palestinian people are the Palestinian people themselves. Not other countries, certainly not their occupier or the armorer and financier of their occupier. And we have to face this uncomfortable truth. In Palestine, 4 years ago, we had the only, if Arab diplomats present will forgive me, we had the only free and fair election ever held in any Arab country ever in history. President Carter himself, Jimmy Carter, who was the chief election monitor, described the Palestinian elections as pristine. His word, pristine, crystal clear. And Hamas won the election. What happened? We, who are forever invading other countries and occupying them in order to impose democracy on them, decided to reject the democratic choice of the Palestinian people and mount a series of sanctions and tolerate an illegal blockade of the Gaza Strip by Israel, which has led not only, according to all the United Nations agencies' reports, check them out, to an era of mass poverty, immiseration, a lost generation of children, of vulnerable people, blockaded, besieged, land, sea, and air, but in the so-called Operation Cast Lead in late December, early January 2009, a murderous assault on an occupied people locked up for the duration as sitting ducks, as fish in a barrel that could be shot. All entrances and exits to Gaza were locked by the people who then rained down death and destruction upon them. Nowhere to run to, nowhere to hide. And again, Western governments did nothing at all about it. 1,600 Palestinians were killed, most of them women and children. Thousands were maimed, many forever, 62,000 houses in an area 21 miles long and 3.5 miles wide. 62,000 houses were destroyed or damaged, not a single one of which has been able to be rebuilt. This siege is a wall. And it's a wall based. How am I doing for time? Ten. It's a wall constructed on what may be the most profound and dangerous misconception, misunderstanding, failure to understand in the world today. And it's this. The failure to understand the Islamic world, the failure to deal with the things that matter to the people in the Islamic world. In fact, the continuing deepening of that swamp has led to in the emergence of an ever more radical and ever more political Islam. I don't myself like that. I want the Arabs to be led by Jamal Abdel Nasser, not Sheikh this or Ayatollah that. If I was in Iran, I would have been with Mossadegh, overthrown by the British and the Americans, leading directly to the emergence of the power of the Ayatollahs in the Islamic Republic of Iran. So don't blame me for the radicalization of the masses in the Muslim world. I was arguing for 35 years, if we don't solve problems like Palestine, you will drive the progressive and nationalist leaderships to the margin, and they'll be replaced by Islamists. I used to tell British government ministers almost on a daily, certainly weekly basis, deal with Arafat. Because after Arafat comes the deluge. After Arafat comes people much harder to deal with. And that's precisely what happened. But it's undoubtedly underway. And if we don't deal with it, who knows how far it will go? If we continue to deepen the swamp, if we continue to enrage people more and more, what will we do except make them more and more angry and radical? And it's not impossible to deal with Islamic governments, real Islamic governments, I mean, like the government of Erdogan in Turkey. We were told by the generals and the far right in Turkey that they could never, would never accept the emergence of Islamic government in Turkey. But they were forced to do so. And it's one of the best and most effective governments in the world. Erdogan is a man admired across the world. The Turkish economy is outperforming China in terms of its annual growth rate. Civil peace and stability has been maintained. Internal and international complications are being resolved on the Kurdish question, on the Cyprus question, on the relationship between Turkey and the Kurdish areas of northern Iraq are either being resolved or are on their way to being resolved, or in any case can only be resolved by the Erdogan government. What's wrong with an Islamic government like Erdogan? Self-respecting government. Genuinely Islamic government. Democratic. Elected. And ready to do business with the world. The government in Turkey springs from exactly the same well as the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. The Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt are not the Taliban. Why do we pretend that they are? Why do we pretend that if there was a free election allowed in Egypt, that it would somehow bring about the emergence of a Taliban or an Al-Qaeda? It wouldn't. It would bring about the emergence of another government like Erdogan's in Egypt, which would be stable, which would do business with the world, and would have the support of the Egyptian people, rather than the tin pot tyranny that we have in Egypt today, which may or may not succeed in passing from father to son the presidency, but will never be able to stabilize the political situation inside Egypt. Well, Hamas are the same. They spring from the same well. Hamas are not Al-Qaeda. Why do we pretend that they are? Al-Qaeda is a pan-Islamist, global terrorist network that kills thousands of people at one go in an act of absolutely indiscriminate terror. Hamas is a national liberation movement fighting on its own land to liberate its own country. It never raised a finger against anyone else, anywhere else, except in Palestine. Why do we conflate the truly dangerous Al-Qaeda phenomenon with Hamas, or for that matter, Hezbollah in Lebanon? Why do we do it? We do it to score cheap propaganda points, to demonize those who are fighting for justice in those two theaters. But of course, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you don't deal with the legitimate demands and requirements of Islamic movements in their own countries, fighting against the foreign occupation of their lands, what will you do except continue to radicalize them in a way that will be bad for them and very bad indeed for us? So this wall of Islamophobia, at best a failure to understand what's happening in the Muslim world, at worst the conscious and deliberate deepening of the swamp of hatred, is a much more significant wall than the Berlin Wall ever was. It's dividing the world in a very dangerous way into a kind of clash of civilizations that's entirely unnecessary, can be avoided, must be avoided. Bigotry, racism, apartheid, Islamophobia, these are all walls. A wall doesn't have to be concrete. I'm for bringing down the walls, the concrete ones and the invisible ones. Thank you very much indeed for listening.
Thank you very much, Mr. Galloway. We now have an opportunity for questions from the audience. So perhaps start at the back since we...
Hello, Mr. Galloway. My name is Gil Morciano. Thank you for an interesting lecture. I'm also the son of a Palestinian dispersed refugee, a Jewish Palestinian refugee, who lived in 400 years in Jerusalem. My grandfather, Joseph Morciano, for 400 years. He was also, by the way, deprived of his rights and kicked off his house by a conquering army, the Jordanian Legion. It was led, and I totally agree with you about that, by British officers. Of course, the British involvement in that issue was unbelievable. The commander of that legion was Ghalab Pasha, a commission officer in the British army, saying something about British involvement, not only against Palestinians, but also against Jews in certain ways. And I would like to maybe put forward a certain, maybe sometime, some kind of alternative narrative in a way, if you will. You mentioned 48, you mentioned the Nakba, obviously a very traumatic event when thousands of Palestinians been deprived and had to live in exile. You failed, I think, to mention 47. You were talking about UN resolutions and their importance. You never really talked about the 47 resolution of the United Nations to a Jewish state, an Arab state, by the UN, and the rejection of that UN partition plan by the Arabs, and the total acceptance of this resolution by the Jews, the Israelis, you can define them however you want. You also failed to mention before 67 and the second occupation of the West Bank, which I am against as a left-wing Israeli and demonstrate against. But you failed to mention the involvement of your beloved Gamal Abdel Nasser in the starting of the 67 war, for example, in closing the Tehran Straits and in pushing army forces into the Sinai Desert, for example, something that I don't think is today questioned. He actually mentioned, in that case, wiping out, and I'm talking about what I read in Arabic, wiping out Israel from the map and throwing the Jews to the sea and doing another Auschwitz for them. Now, of course, the ability
Nasser
to start...
Nasser said another Auschwitz?
Nasser didn't say another Auschwitz.
I know that he
but
said.
Nasser, but Shukairi did said that if anybody going to be left of what we're going to do to the Jews in 67, if anybody going to be left, we're going to send them on ships. But let's not go into specifics because let's stay in the conceptual level in that issue. You were talking about the corruption of Arab regimes. You mentioned Egypt in particular. Is it related in any way to the fact that the Egyptian government is throwing you out of the Sinai Desert, calling you a persona non grata? You also mentioned Syria in the past, Bashar al-Assad. You praised him. Well, it's really odd because Bashar al-Assad's father, what was his name? Hafez al-Assad. Another from son to Hafez al-Assad also killed 30,000 Syrians while driving with tanks over Halab because he was trying to fight the Muslim Brotherhood. So just to sum that up, I just wanted to say one thing about the flotilla issue. I was only once in my life in Turkey. And the amazing thing, I was in Turkey as an Israeli soldier. You know why I was in Turkey as an Israeli soldier? I was helping the Turks get dead people and live people out of the ruins of the earthquake underneath. Pro bono. And I didn't see any Iranian. I didn't see Warren Wanton over there. But I see Israeli soldier who saved the life. We saved two babies in my hand. It was one of the most amazing experiences in my life. Israel and Turkey used to have an unbelievable relations. Now, it's kind of odd to me why an Irish man, with all the problems that Ireland have, obviously, I mean, used to have and today, are telling us, the Egyptians, the Turks, the Israelis, the Palestinians, what we should think, what we should do. Me and my colleague here are part of a joint Israeli-Palestinian fellowship. And we are really believing in throwing away walls, you know, it's pretty hard. Because of ignorance on both sides, because of criticism I have on Israeli government, on settlements. But in the end, when you support Hamas, when you support a regime, and I'm not talking ideological support, I'm talking about giving money. And you've been photoed with dollars in your hand to Mahmoud Zahar, the Minister of Foreign Affairs in the Hamas government, just this week said, how can the, okay, just going to finish and going to sum it up, how does the West has their nerve to preach us? They are led by gay people and homosexuals. This is your legacy. I mean, those people that you are giving money to, that in their constitutional declaration they write, the Jews, one day in the day of reckoning, we're going to kill all the Jews. And if they're going to...
Who are you quoting now?
I'm quoting the Hamas memorandom. If a Jew...
You're a little slack.
No. This is going to be the last sentence. There's an asymmetry, you know. I'm not as an Israeli, as an occupier, as an imperialist. I'm not used to asymmetry when, you know, I'm the weak one. And so I'm trying to... This is going to be the last thing, and I'm going
to... I hope so.
Sorry to waste your time, and I apologize for the entire audience. I just... Okay, I'm just going to finish with that and I'm going to conclude with it.
No, I'm grateful.
What is your vision in order to drop walls, okay, not to build new walls?
Okay. The problem is, if I take as long to answer you as you took to question me, nobody else will get a question in, and that would be, I think, unfair. No, I'm addressing the person at the back who was heckling a moment ago. You're of course inevitably in a short contribution, extremely selective in your quotations, and also a little unclear, if you don't mind me saying so, on the attribution of those quotations. I could answer you with 1,000 quotations. I could remind you of General Aitan's description of the Palestinian people as drugged cockroaches in a bottle. I could remind you of the former tourism minister of Israel who described the Palestinian people as lice, human lice, who had to be cleansed from all the land of Israel. Or perhaps you'll recognize this one from Golda Meir in 1968 when she said there is no such thing as a Palestinian. The Palestinian people never existed. It's a direct quotation from a prime minister of Israel, which you, as a self-described left-wing Israeli, maybe have some fond regard for, in the way that I have for Nasser. But it won't take us very far forward if we merely swap atrocity quotes. Let's deal with the realities. The West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem are illegally occupied. That's why you demonstrate against them. It took Israel 6 days to occupy them, but it's taken Israel 43 years to withdraw from that occupation. And moreover, entirely illegally, they have entirely changed, not entirely changed, they have substantially changed the demographics of the occupied territory illegally, to the extent that, together with the wall and the rest, it's very difficult to see how these International Security Council resolutions could be implemented without the destruction of hundreds of thousands of homes, without the destruction of the apartheid wall and all the rest. The second reality, and I address you now as a former refugee, as you described yourself, is that there are millions of Palestinian people who are either the people driven out of Palestine in 48 or 67, or are the children or even grandchildren of those people, who have the keys to the houses now lived in by Israeli citizens, who have the title to the land now enjoyed by Israeli citizens, most of whom are not refugees from Jerusalem, but are people who came from New York, or from London, or from Paris, where they already had homes, and where no one was seeking to drive them out of those homes. So we have a conflict of a significant number of people, Jewish, Muslim, Christian, who wish to live, and some have title to live, on a small piece of land. So you ask me, what do I project as a solution to this? Maybe as a left-wing Israeli, you'll buy this, though I suspect that you won't. We should have one democratic state between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea, called Israel-Palestine, or Palestine-Israel, whichever you prefer, in which the Jews, the Muslims, and the Christians live as equal citizens under the law. It's not a Jewish state. It's not an Islamic state. It's not a Christian state. It's a democratic state. One man, one woman, one vote, one government, one law. That was good enough for South Africa at the end of apartheid. Why should it not be good enough as a means of resolving this conflict? The only argument against it is the one adduced by Mr. Lieberman, of whom I'm sure you're not a fan, who is asking the non-Jewish citizens of what is now called Israel to sign an oath that they accept Israel as a Jewish state. Even the Ku Klux Klan would never have required the blacks in America to sign an oath that America was a white country. Yet this is the demand of the foreign minister. Not a charter written long ago, not an ancient quotation from a discredited former leader of the PLO. This is today's Israeli foreign minister, is demanding non-Jewish citizens of the state of Israel sign such an oath. That's the only argument against a democratic, secular state of Israel-Palestine, that somehow the current citizens of Israel have the right to maintain what they call a Jewish state, in which Jews are first-class citizens and others are less, on land stolen from someone else, and a state paid for by other people, which couldn't exist if it were not for the subventions from the United States, from the special relationship with the European Union. You can go on, my friend, asking for that. But I'm afraid in the bank of international public opinion, in the bank in which your political capital was invested, your account is running dangerously close to red. You shake your head. Israel still has allies, that's true, but it doesn't have any love. Nobody loves Israel. Ask Obama. Ask the Obama administration, off the record, what they think of Netanyahu and Lieberman and their gang. And that which is true in the United States, and I gave you the quotation from General Petraeus, is true in virtually every country in the world. So time is running out, and you are surprised, indeed even critical, of the fact that I, as an Irish Scotsman, should be so interested in events in Palestine. Well, you're just going to have to get used to it. I'm sorry. Thank you very much.
I'm going to take the first three questions I saw when Mr. Galloway first asked a question.
Hi, I'm Anna. I'm from Canada, and I just have a short question. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Each time, or at least lately, when we criticize Israel, we are accused of being anti-Semitic. And it's actually very hard to voice an opinion about or to talk about anything that comes close to the conflict, because we are accused of being either pro or against Israel. And I think, and I'm just asking you, if we shouldn't make a difference, or the intellectual world in the West shouldn't be more clear about the difference between Judaism and support for Judaism and Zionism. Because I think there's nothing wrong with being against Zionism, but people mix it with being anti-Semitic, and especially with the tradition that we had in Europe of being anti-Semitic and taking for granted the achievements that the Jewish community in the past and in the present are doing. I think we should just be more clear on that and make a difference between, because when we are not, we're actually, I think, alienating a lot of the middle class in Israel, and also a lot of the Jews in the Western world, because they feel threatened. They feel like we have, by criticizing Israel, we're actually criticizing them, when in fact it's really more Zionism and not Judaism. Thank you.
One at a time? Well, it's getting easier in Canada. I shall be there speaking in 10 cities from the 16th of November until the 27th of this month. This follows a decision by the Canadian High Court in a 60-page judgment to utterly condemn the previous decision by the Immigration Minister of Canada, Jason Kenney, to exclude me from the country on the same bogus and false pretext adduced by our Israeli friend just a few minutes ago. The High Court judge directly accused and condemned the Canadian government for deliberately criminalizing pro-Palestinian activism in Canada, when in fact it was an entirely legitimate political point of view. That's why I flew to Toronto for one day to celebrate the court's decision, and why I'm speaking in 10 cities, including in the Parliament in Quebec, this month. The argument that somebody like me could be against Jews is absurd, and I seldom stoop to even address it. I am a man of the left all of my life. I am a Marxist. Marx was a Jew. Chomsky is a Jew. Einstein was a Jew. Epstein was a Jew. Trotsky was a Jew. The idea that somebody like me could be against Jews is as absurd as saying that somebody like me could be against black people. And it's true that one of the weapons that supporters of Israel reach for is the charge that those of us who are against the political, ideological idea called Zionism are anti-Semitic. This is negated by several factors. First, my own character and political life, which is a matter of public record going back decades on YouTube, in Parliament, in many other cuttings and means of discovery. I have never in my life thought an anti-Semitic thought or said an anti-Semitic word. Secondly, by the fact that the Arabs are Semites. As a matter of fact, according to recent scholarship, including a very important book out this year called The Myth of the Jewish People, it's likely that a very substantial number of Jews, including Jews living in Israel, are not Semitic at all, but are people from the Caucasus who converted to Judaism. That doesn't affect my attitude to them in terms of their rights to continue to live in Israel-Palestine, but it's likely to turn out to be scientifically factual. So, my advice to you is not to fear this charge, because to do so would be to succumb to a kind of intellectual terrorism, to terrify you out of speaking up for the victims of an injustice, because otherwise you might be accused of anti-Semitism. There are hundreds of thousands of Jews in Israel who support justice for the Palestinian people. There are millions of Jews in the world who support justice for the Palestinian people. Our opposition is to an ideology that we regard as a racist, apartheid ideology, which has been disastrous for everybody, including the Jews. Zionism was founded by atheistic Jews. None of them had any biblical claims in mind. They were ready to form their settler state in many different places. In Patagonia, in the Seychelles, in Uganda. They were ready to form their settler state called Israel in those places if the empire had given them those lands. It's only later, ex post facto, that we have this biblical, as if God were an estate agent, arrant nonsense that God promised the Zionists this land. It's an absolute absurdity, and it should be treated with the disdain all the disdain that we can muster. So don't be afraid in Canada or anywhere else from speaking up for what's right, because our opponents will throw mud at us. They're running out of mud to throw.
Final question.
My name is Wolfgang Pasternak. I'm from Germany. Thank you very much for this very passionate and impressive plaidoyer, which I think is particularly fitting because a year ago to this day, I think, we had two Israeli colleagues from the foreign ministry speaking to us. Now, I have a very brief question. Obviously, you are seasoned in dealing with all kinds of criticism. What are the three most valid points that you think friends of Israel, Israelis, Jews, whatever, the three most valid points that you think can be raised in defense of the current situation of Israel, and what's your response to those most three valid points?
Well, the first one is the 1956, I think, or 57 proclamation by Shukeri, the leader of the PLO before Arafat, that the Israelis will be driven into the sea. I'm against driving anyone into the sea. It's impossible to drive a heavily armed, nuclear armed state of Israel into the sea. In any case, we need to, in advancing, someone like me, in advancing the case for a binational state, democratic, Israel-Palestine, Palestine-Israel, we need to make it very clear that our friend, who was exiled for 400 years, I think you said, from Jerusalem, I think that's the figure you used, I was finding it difficult myself to compute, that they are and ought to stay there. I think many would leave. Some of there, especially the Russian emigrants, because they couldn't get into the United States. They don't really want to be living in a settlement town in Beersheba. They would rather be in New York. Who wouldn't? They probably would not stay. Others, zealots of the kind that you find on the settlements, usually speaking in Brooklyn accents, would leave because it was no longer an exclusivist Jewish state. But I would hope, just like happened in South Africa, though it didn't happen in some other decolonized parts of Africa, that the settlers would stay. I think the state would be more successful if they stayed. I was deeply involved in the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, including working underground for the African National Congress under apartheid, living with Jews, by the way, members of the African National Congress, the Coleman family and many other Jewish activists in the African National Congress. Mandela was asked by the Boers, by the settlers, when it was clear that freedom was coming to South Africa, can we have a small part of the country, the Orange Free State, as a white country? And Mandela said, we don't believe in white countries or black countries. We just believe in democratic countries. And this is the argument which I believe is insuperable, which I advance for a binational state in Palestine. What other arguments do they have? Well, I think if I were them, I'd make more of the fact that anti-Semitism as an endemic, murderous, and here in Germany and in German-occupied Europe, genocidal mania is one of the reasons for the creation of this state. What, of course, that misses is that the Palestinians had nothing whatsoever to do with the Holocaust. It was you, Christians, Europeans, who either carried out the Holocaust or turned their eyes away as it developed and was allowed to reap this mass death of millions of people, and if they had been able to, all of the Jews in Europe would have been murdered by this. But the Palestinians had nothing to do with it. In fact, Jews lived in Palestine as neighbors with Christians and Muslims for centuries without any tension or problems of any kind. So I think the European Christian countries should try harder to resolve this problem than they're currently trying, whether out of guilt or out of imperial strategy in the past, is open to debate. You asked me for three. I'm genuinely struggling to find a third.
Obviously, it's a very emotional issue, and I know many of you still have questions, but our next speaker is waiting patiently downstairs, and our time with Mr. Galloway has run out, so please join me in thanking him for his time here with us this evening.